Okay, so here we are, and let me just check. So my former student, Randy Jocelyn, I just heard from her this morning. I had told her about this. She's up in Connecticut now, but she has a course. She teaches writing, and so she's teaching a course on Sunday mornings, but she said she's rescheduling it, so next week she should be on. Well, anyway, this is September 20th, 2020, 2-9-2020. How about that? And let me recap. I'm still talking about the background to what we'll be dealing with this semester, or however long it takes us. And so let me just kind of recap. Last week, I began the background discussion, and first of all, I talked about what we had discussed in this class 17-18 years ago, 2002-2003, when we talked about Islamic theology and philosophy. And I pointed out that at the time I hadn't even said anything about the Quran, but I want to remedy that, I guess, that gap this time. And then Randy, the woman I was referring to a few minutes ago, she and I read the Quran together a number of years ago, so that's why I wanted to do this in this class. And then after that, I mentioned a couple of philological concerns that I simply wanted to mention out of a sense of responsibility, but not really pursue, because I'm not an expert in all of this. And Tom actually sort of corroborated one of my points earlier, and that was, that there has been some controversy about the actual authorship of the Quran. But in this class, I will assume the traditional view that it's one person, and because it does strike me, as I explained last time, it does strike me as the work of one person because it is so repetitive, and I'll just accept the traditional view that that person was Muhammad. So I'll leave it at that. The other philological issue that I mentioned had to do with variants in the text. And it would be virtually impossible that there are not, that at some point there were not variants in the text. But the text, as established roughly about 20 years after Muhammad's death, is considered to be the official text of the Quran. And so I will also proceed under the assumption that this is it. And, we won't revisit these philological matters again, because, what we want to do is grasp an overall picture of what's going on in the Quran, which was my third topic that I talked about last week, which is really the most important thing. I don't want to get confused, or I don't want to obscure the forest because of all the trees. It's fine to look at the trees, but it's much more meaningful to look at them when you understand what the forest looks like. And what I want to do more than anything else is to present an overarching picture of what's going on in the Quran. And that leads me to ask the question, what is the major topic in the work, of all the various topics that are touched on? And I criticized something I found online that attempted to talk about the topics in the Quran, but the topics that person chose were the kind of things that we 21st century American Christians worry about, jihad, the status of women, stuff like that. And that's really not understanding or trying to understand the Quran on its own terms. So I proposed then that, or at least it seems to me, that the major theme in the Quran centers around prophethood. And I explained all that in the context of the assumption that God is absolutely, infinitely just. And the justice of God requires, first of all, it requires certain behaviors on the part of human beings, but it also requires that no one or no group, because we're talking about groups, remember, no group is going to be tested in the balance without having been given a warning as to what is expected of those people. So prophets are messengers, they're warners. Their job is to tell some group of people to shape up. And of course, also because God is perfectly just. If they shape up, they will be richly rewarded. But of course, if they don't, they will wish they had never been born. And we'll see abundant evidence of that. I do think that this idea of divine justice is the major attribute of God as expressed in these warnings that are given by the various prophets. Then I was talking about, there are 25 prophets altogether. And the first one's Adam. The last one's Muhammad. The second to the last one, number 24, is Jesus. And then I pointed out that there are a few that when we look down the names of the prophets, like Hud and Saleh and Suad, who are they? But they have indeed been identified with various Old Testament figures. So if you accept those identifications, then what we have, interestingly, is we have 24 of the 25 prophets who are actually somewhere in the Bible. And of the 24, 21 are in the Old Testament, 3 are in the New Testament. So that's why any Jew or Christian reading the Quran cannot but be struck by how much of the Bible there is in the Quran. So I went into explaining some of that, and by pointing out that there are a lot of Christians, Jews and Christians in the Arabian Peninsula during Muhammad's time. The kingdom of Aksum, right across the sea, was Christian. Some of Muhammad's companions took refuge there for a while, even. Muhammad's cousin was supposedly a Christian. I mean, so he would have had lots of opportunity to hear some of the stories and understand some of the theology behind both Judaism and Christianity. Lots of opportunities. I didn't quite finish that discussion, so I'm going to continue in that vein for a little bit this morning. When one is struck by the parallels that one finds in the Bible, one is also struck by the different twists on a lot of the stories from what we're familiar with. You'll read along and you'll be reading about Moses or about Lot or about David or about Adam or about Abraham or Jesus, and I get that, I remember that, and then you'll hit some detail or other or maybe just some coloring, some twist, some spin on the story. And your immediate reaction is, wait a minute, that's not the way it goes. What does that mean? Well, that doesn't necessarily, as I think I said last week, that shouldn't be a cudgel by which to beat up on the Muslims. You guys just don't have it right. It's not that. It's really that it's an indication that Christianity even Judaism of the 7th century are a lot more fluid, we're a lot more fluid than we normally think of it now. We don't think of, we have a fairly fixed idea, this is what Christianity is. But honestly, in the early centuries, that fixed idea wasn't really there. That's why ecumenical councils were convened, for one thing, in order to hash out doctrine, because there was disagreement over what Christianity even was, and those are theological disagreements, but there were even variants on the stories that were in circulation in Christian areas. I'm reminded, actually, of the Nag Hammadi. When I read the Quran and when I read overlaps with the Bible in the Quran. I'm reminded a lot of the Nag Hammadi Library. Totally different story here, but hear me out. The Nag Hammadi Library was a codex that was discovered in the 1940s. I think it had been buried in a cave in a jar, or something. I think it was a jar. Anyway, the erosion had finally caused it to fall out and down onto the land, you know, below the cave, which is up on a cliff or something. And this codex was full of Gnostic Christian stories. It was mostly a Gnostic document. Lots and lots of stories in the document, but in the codex. But they were most of them were Gnostic, but they were Gnostic stories with a Christian twist. Or I should put it the other way: they were Christian stories. A lot of them with a Gnostic twist. And interestingly, scholars think that codex probably was in the library of a Christian monastery. And you say, why in the world were all these Gnostic writings sitting in the library of a Christian monastery? Well, the answer must have been that at one time they seemed legit. They seemed like legitimate religious literature. They were probably buried in around 400. They were probably buried because of people like Epiphanius, who was like a heresy hunter, went around accusing various, you know, monks here and there of heresy and so forth. And I think maybe they valued the book. They thought, well, we'll let this blow over and then we'll get it back out again. Well, I guess it never blew over. But at any rate, that too is an illustration of the variance in stories that we find in the early Christian centuries. Things were a lot more fluid, and the Quran is exactly the same kind of thing. You read the stories, and you know you can't but be struck by the little twists that are not familiar to us from the Bible. And also, you have to remember, I mean, so what the Quran is then, even if you could care less about, nobody here it falls into this category, but even if you couldn't care less about Islam and you were just interested, say, in Christian history, history of the church or something like that, even if you were that kind of person, it would still be important to read what's in the Quran, if for no other reason than to determine or get a sense of the kinds of stories that were circulating in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century under the name of Christianity. And also, you know, the Arabian Peninsula is not Constantinople, right? I mean, it really is the boonies. It really is a backwater. So you might say, well, they never got the memo about this and this and this. Well, maybe not. You know, it's the boondocks. They're out there, you know, in kind of nowhere. And these stories are still circulating. So anyway, that's really interesting from the point of view of church history, if nothing else, you know. So. Now, how do you like my new microphone, by the way? I got this new lapel microphone the other day. People in my Ollie classes, some of them, you know, some of them are kind of elderly, and sometimes they say that they have a hard time hearing me. So I thought I'd get a lapel mic, and I got one earlier, and it had the wrong kind of connection to it, so I had to buy yet another one that has a USB connection. And this one's 6.5 feet, so I'm really stretching it if I want to write on the board, which I'm going to be doing in just a minute. But anyway, so this is what my new little gizmo.
It does seem to work well.
Good. I'm glad. Okay. All right. So before I go to the next topic, which is some of the peculiarities that you find when you read the Quran, I want to say something about Arabic. Who was it? Was it Tom asked me about Arabic this morning? Lo and behold, I want to say something about Arabic because I want to I feel strongly that, you know, if you're studying a religious text in a language that, at least classical Arabic, from the point of view of a Muslim, is like a, almost like a sacred language, kind of like Hebrew or Sanskrit for, Hinduism, that it's a matter of, just sort of basic courtesy, I think, to try to get the words right. I know it would be pedantic, and besides that, I'm not qualified to tell you how a native speaker of Arabic would actually sound these words, because there are a lot of sounds in Arabic that we don't have in English, and so it would take some, some work to master all that. I don't aspire to that in any way at all. But I do want to, as we go through this, I do want to at least spell things correctly. And there's a lot of sloppiness out there, especially on the internet. I have some books here that I rely on more that are a lot more careful about how they transliterate the Arabic. But I do want to digress for maybe 10 or 15 minutes on Arabic. And actually, I'm going to send out, that's another thing I'm going to send out sometime this week to everybody, is I put some slides together on it. And I think you'll find it interesting anyway. So let me just digress for a bit before I get into the details about, what this book is like. Arabic falls into the Afro-Asiatic language family. Afro-Asiatic. That language family is a sibling to Indo-European. So, English, for example, is an Indo-European language. But Afro-Asiatic is another family that is, like I say, a sibling to the Indo-European family. There are keep in mind that linguists disagree about a lot of there's some gray areas here. I'm going to present a certain viewpoint. There are some other discussions going on among professional linguists that I'm not even going to get into. I don't even know the details of them. I just know that they're out there. But for our purposes here, there are six subfamilies underneath the Afro-Asiatic linguistic family. Those subfamilies are Berber, Chadic, Cushitic, Egyptian, Amadic, and Semitic. Six. So Berber, Chadic, Cushitic, Egyptian, Amadic, and Semitic. In ancient times, the Berber languages were in northwestern Africa, in what's now Algeria, Morocco, that general area. The Chadic languages were more in central Africa, kind of south of the Berber languages. Egyptian, of course, in Egypt. The Semitic languages throughout the Near East and also into the Horn of Africa. Chadic and Amadic, also down in the Horn of Africa. Okay. Well, Arabic, of course, is a Semitic language. So let's zoom in to that one. In antiquity, this is yet another point of somewhat controversy, but once again, I'm presenting what I think is probably the most current view. In antiquity, Semitic languages formed three groups. Now we're in sub-subfamilies. Three groups. One group is East Semitic. When I was in Chicago and I took Akkadian for a year just for fun. And Akkadian is the language whose major dialects are Assyrian and Babylonian Assyrian. Well, that's the major East Semitic language. East Semitic languages have now all gone extinct. Yeah. The second division of Semitic languages are now called Central Semitic. Back in the day, it was Northwest Semitic, and there was a question about where Arabic fits. I'm going to adopt the position that there the other two language groups underneath Semitic language besides East Semitic are Central Semitic and South Semitic. The Central Semitic languages include all the ones you've heard of, I'm sure, you know, Hebrew and Aramaic, but also Arabic. The South Semitic languages, the most important representative of that group is Amharic, which is spoken in Ethiopia. As a matter of fact, when you read the news about, you know, ethnic divisions or ethnic strife in Ethiopia, some of it is linguistic, because you have your Amharic speakers there, you have your Cushitic speakers and your Semitic speakers right there in that same country. But anyway, the major Semitic, South Semitic language is Amharic. Actually, I've read somewhere that is the second most widely spoken Semitic language, second only to Arabic, of course. All right. So anyway, that's where Arabic fits in. It's in the Afro-Asiatic family, the Semitic subfamily, the Central Semitic subfamily. So, with that as a classification, let's look at some of the details of the language and how we transliterate it. The Arabic alphabet, just like Hebrew, is all consonants. So no surprise there. I mean, Semitic languages seem to have that attribute. All consonants. The original Phoenician alphabet consisted of 22 letters. The Hebrew alphabet is almost identical. I mean, the names are slightly different from the Phoenician names, but it's very close, and still the same 22 letters as the old original Phoenician alphabet. The Phoenicians, you know, they were the ones that propagated, I guess I would say, the first alphabet. Remember, before you had alphabetic scripts, you had syllabic scripts. So, for example, Akkadian is a good example of that. If you wanted to spell the name Don, you would use two syllables. There's a da, you'd use a da sign, followed by an on sign, and the ah sound would just be elided between the two. So it would be a da on, so that would be Don. But you would not do like D-O-N, because they had no letters. They just had syllables. That was true of Akkadian. It was true of Sumerian. It was true of the Egyptian language, too. Egyptian was written in three different kinds of scripts. There was the hieroglyphic that we're all familiar with for formal inscriptions. There was the hieratic, which was the priestly script, and then demotic, which is like, I guess, kind of like for us, it would be kind of like cursive. It was the quick one that everybody used for, you know, jotting down accounts, and, you know, just whatever you need. You'd use that script because it was easy. Apparently, in Palestine, in the general area of Palestine, somebody had the bright idea, or somebody's had the bright idea, that you can take some of these demotic signs and make them stand for more primitive things than syllables, i.e. phonemes, actual, you know, what we think of as letters. Like, instead of da, as in da-on, just d, and just n, see? And that's the origin of the alphabet, but it's the Phoenicians who picked up on it, and because they were seafaring people, spread it around. And of course the Greeks got it from the Phoenicians, and the Greeks are the ones who invented the vowels, because as I said, the Phoenician alphabet had no vowels. Yeah.
Getting back to Egyptian, where does Coptic fit in?
Well, Coptic is the Egyptian language.
Yes.
Recent. I say more recent, very ancient, but more recent than ancient Egyptian. But of course, it's not spoken. I mean, it's a liturgical language now.
Yes.
It's not spoken anymore. Yeah.
Right. Thank you.
So anyway, when the Arabs got a hold of the alphabet, they needed, as the Greeks did too, they had sounds that were not covered, at least to their satisfaction, by the 22 letters. So they expanded it by 6 letters. Also, some of the letters actually changed in their pronunciation. They evolved. For example, K in Phoenician, P-E, became Fa. The P became aspirated as a P, and a aspirated P can easily convert to a F sound. Next thing you know, you're going right. So the P-E became Fa, and that's an example. But a lot of them didn't change very much at all. Anyway, so we have 28 consonants in the Arabic alphabet. Now, of those 28, 16 can come over to our Latin alphabet fairly straightforwardly. So I'm going to list them on the board. The ones that can be transliterated without too much change. And so when we Romanize it, i.e. when we convert it to the Latin alphabet, we're able to have a one-to-one relationship between the Arabic consonant and one of the consonants that we use. Okay? Those letters are, and here's the acid test for my new mic. I mean, you can see this, right? Yeah, you can see this. I hope I get all these right. I really am at the as far as this will go. B, D, F, H, J, K, L, M, N, Q, R, S, T, W, Y, Z. Yes. So that's 16. So 16 of the 28 letters come across, reasonably well.
Fun?
Yes.
Is it strange that both K and Q are there? Because it seems like they would have the same sound.
Well, the Q is farther back. You can make a K sound by using the back of your tongue against the soft palate, as opposed to k, you know what I mean? So I can say k, and that's, if you think about where that is, that's up near the roof of your mouth, k, k. But you can go like that, and that's what the Q represents.
Well, that's why the Quran starts with a Q or a K.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they're similar. They're similar, of course. But the Q is the one that represents best how it's actually spoken when they say the word. Okay. All right, what about the remaining 12 letters? Two of them are represented by apostrophes, either a forward apostrophe or a backward apostrophe. Okay. The forward apostrophe is our good old friend Aleph, first letter in the alphabet. It's the same as the Greek alpha. Okay. The backward apostrophe is hain. That's spelled I don't know if that's a long I or not. I didn't write it down. You can think of them as, at least I think of them as, two kinds of glottal stops. I think it's more complicated than that, but this is the way I think of it. When you say a vowel, the beginning of the vowel is a kind of sound, right? If you just, if you start from nothing and say or ih or ooh, there's a right at the very beginning. And that's the glottal stop, and whether that glottal stop is toward the front of your mouth, like is or way back in your throat, kind of like you're clearing your throat. It would be the difference between those two. Okay? So that takes us down to 10 more. Right? Now we got 18 up here, and there are 10 left. Of the 10, 5 are examples of what I said a minute ago. They are aspirated forms of other standard consonants. So, those are DH, KH, have I got that right? No, I'm sorry. DH, yeah, that's right, there is a DH. I'm not going to try to go in that order. I have a different order in my mind. So I'm going to do it this way. KH, GH, TH, DH, and SH. All right. Now, if this was Sanskrit, they would literally be aspirated forms. So the KH would be k, as opposed to k, you know, k, as opposed, you know, k, with a lot of breath in it, k, as opposed to k. But in Arabic, the aspiration seems to have altered the consonant into more of a fricative kind of thing. So you go, like a German ich, you know, that sort of thing. And the GH is the same thing except voiced, right? So we don't have that sound in English. This becomes not t, but just as in English, you know. This becomes not d, but the, as in the word the, and that's sh, as it looks. So we have those 5 aspirates, and then we have 5 more. And those are, and linguists, I think, tend to use the symbol with the diacritic when you have a dot under the letter to indicate consonants that normally are formed toward the front of your mouth, but in this case get formed more toward the back of your mouth. Certainly in Sanskrit, I mean, I can talk a lot about Sanskrit. In Sanskrit, for example, a T or a D with a dot means, you know, normally if you think about it, when you say a T, your tongue is right behind your front teeth. But in Sanskrit, the T with the dot under it is formed right over the roof of your mouth. So you, instead of going T, you go T. And instead of a D, you go D. And they sound a little different. Now, to our ear, we're not attuned even listening for those differences, so you know. But obviously, if you grow up in a society where those differences are important, then you do quickly learn to hear them. Well, anyway, I don't believe it's the retroflex sound that's indicated by the dot in the case of Arabic. I think it's farther back. But anyway, the dot indicates that, which I'm going to put up in a minute, that these kind of forward consonants have their origin farther back in your mouth. So they are really represent different sounds. And the dots belong to our good friends, once again, T, D, S, Z, and H.
The dots.
So, for example, the name of the prophet is not, it's not Mohammed, it's not even Muhammad, it's Muhammad, right? There's a more of a guttural, Arabic is a very guttural language anyway. So, but anyway, that's a good illustration of what I mean. So, as opposed to, right? So that is an important difference in Arabic, and we don't have a in our Latin alphabet. So what we do is we use the dot notation, the diacritic, this dot, to indicate that the sound has an origin farther back in your mouth. Okay. So that's our 28 consonants. Now, of course, the next question you might ask is, well, what about vowels? You know? I mean, you know, all languages have vowels. You know, well, of course, Hebrew, you know, the vowels are indicated not by letters, but by diacritics. They have their own diacritics, right? You're familiar with that, right? They have these dots that they use. I mean, I think once you master the language, you don't use them very much, but for people whose native language is not Hebrew, the dots come in, you know, really handy to indicate what the vowel is between the various consonants. Well, it's the same in Arabic. You don't use letters to indicate vowels. You use diacritics. There are six vowels in Arabic. And really, what they are long and short and long versions of three vowels. So really only three vowels. That's why, by the way, if you see an E or an O in a word that supposedly transcribes an Arabic word, that just can't be right. There are no E's in Arabic. There are no O's in Arabic. The only vowels are A, I, and U, short and long. Now, if you want to represent a short A, you do that with a little stroke above the consonant. If you want to represent a short I, you do that with a little stroke below the consonant. If you want to represent a short U, you do that with a kind of apostrophe-looking thing, kind of like this. Not this one right here, like the aleph, but above the consonant. Okay. Those are called fatha, kasra, and dhamma. Note the dot there. Fatha, kasra. Oops, these all have H's on the end zone. Kasra and dhamma. Okay. So the fatha is a short A, the kasra is a short I, and the dhamma is a short U. Well, how do you form the long vowels? Very cleverly. You simply take the consonant that is closest in sound to the vowel and append it to the fatha, kasra, or dhamma. Well, okay, I'm kind of running out of room, but it's okay. I should have moved this to the left. But so the consonant closest to an A sound is aleph. Now that makes a long A. The consonant closest to a I sound is the last. Aleph, of course, is the first letter in the alphabet. The last letter in the alphabet is yah. So that creates a long I. And then the consonant closest to the U sound is the second to the last letter of the alphabet. That's wow. So that's how you form the long vowels. Those three consonants do double duty. So they normally are just consonants, but if they follow one of these short vowel diacritics, they lengthen the vowel. So that's how you can have a language consisting of all consonants and yet be able to spell any word because every word's going to have a vowel in it. So this is our set of So if I say, if I put, you know, over here A, I, and U, so this is our set of 28 consonants plus 6 vowels. So every Arabic word then would be transliterated, romanized, using that set of 34 symbols. Okay? So, for example, the word Quran. It's not Koran. It's not K-O-R-A-N. First of all, there's no O. Right? But and it's two syllables. Well, of course it's two syllables, but Kur is the first one. And then you have an aleph. The glottal stop. And then a long A, Quran. The difference between, by the way, a short and a long vowel, I should have mentioned this, is not like in English, where we actually change the sound of it, but it's like in Greek and Sanskrit, actually. It has to do literally with how long you hold the vowel. So you might put it this way, you might put it in sort of musical terms. You hold a short vowel for one beat, you hold a long vowel for two beats. So a short A would be ah, and a long A would be ah, or e, or oo, that kind of thing. Now, of course, it's not that long, but, and of course, and we, of course, English speakers, vowel quantity, length of time you hold a vowel, that has, you know, we don't, that's just not part of our way of distinguishing words for us. It might have other functions, you know, like emphasis, perhaps, but certainly not to distinguish two words from one another. But it's important in several languages, and it's important in Arabic, and that's the difference between short and long vowels. So anyway, as we're going through, all I'm trying to do is romanize things correctly. And as I say, there's a lot of sloppiness out there. I hope I've got everything right. But if you, in your, you know, researches or whatever you're reading, if you find that, you know, I've misspelled something, please let me know. I'll try to fix it. Because it's sometimes really hard to find out, unless you read the Arabic script, which I really don't do very well. Questions? Was somebody going to ask me a question?
Don,
yeah.
Why not just use the International Phonetic Alphabet? Why bother with trying to transliterate in the 21st
century?
Well,
you could do that, I suppose. That's a possibility. You know, but actually transliterating it, it's a question, I guess, of asking about pronunciation versus asking about reproducing the spelling. And if you do the IPA, then you're really conveying how it's pronounced versus how it's actually spelled. I mean, I'm not going to use it and go stand up here and try to use an Arabic script or anything, but there will be a one-to-one relationship between the letters I put on the board and the actual letters in the, well, except for the aspirated ones, but, you know, they kind of go together. So,
gotcha. All right.
Yeah. And actually, too, if you look at the IPA would actually have the real pronunciation. Well, some of those sounds don't really occur in English, so it would sound very pedantic for me to stand up here and try to talk like I'm a native Arab. Other questions?
Don, I have one.
Yeah.
You know, as you said in the opening last week, you know, the Arabic is supposed to be perfect, unchanged.
Right.
You know, and so I was thinking about Shakespeare, who was, you know, far closer to our time than the prophet.
Yeah.
And English is pronounced differently. A lot of words Shakespeare used are now have different meanings. You know, you have to have a notes when you read Shakespeare that he really meant this instead of that.
Right.
To make that claim for this text, which is almost 1,000 years older, mm-hmm. seems hard to say that things haven't evolved.
Well, certainly the, I mean, no Muslim would say that the language has not changed. Of course it's changed. And, you know, when you learn the Quran, and there's a, I watched some amazing videos. That's the nice thing. I will say books are generally preferable to what you find online. But one thing you can't get out of a book is how it sounds, and there are a lot of neat videos out there. There's one I watched of a little boy learning the Quran. He was amazing. He was sitting, so his instructor was, they were kind of cross-legged across from one another with just a few feet apart. And he was correcting him when he was going through and that sort of thing. Well, he was learning classical Arabic. He did not natively speak classical Arabic. He was learning it. Also learning how to chant it as well, by the way. So it would be like maybe a closer analogy would be suppose I stood up here and read from the Canterbury Tales, you know, in Middle English. You could do that. I could do that. Fine. The language has changed in the meantime. Okay, fine. But this is how it was pronounced back here, and so we try to do that.
The student today has to learn that some words that the prophet used may mean something different.
Sure. I'm sure there are many words in the Quran that are not part of contemporary, you know, speech. I'm sure that's true. Just as there are in Shakespeare and in the Canterbury Tales. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know if that was considered, you know, I don't know what the right word would be, like sacrilegious or something, that there's pressure to keep words that the prophet used stable.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you can't really fight language evolution.
No, I don't think so. I mean, sometimes great literatures exert a conservative force over the evolution of language. That's certainly true. I once asked my Greek teacher in Chicago, I think I've told this story before, you may remember it. I asked him once how much modern Greek differed from ancient Greek, and he said, it depends on your politics. He says, if you pick up a conservative newspaper, it's really amazing, for considering how much time has elapsed, amazingly close to the Greek of Plato, you know. But if you pick up a liberal newspaper, it's got all sorts of slang and stuff like that in there. So. But clearly, having a classical literature there does exercise a bit of a brake, I think, on linguistic evolution. And that would be true probably here too, as well, I imagine. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Well, I have a few minutes. I can begin to talk about the Quran and some of its peculiarities. Let's see. Okay. The Quran is divided into 114 surahs. A surah is kind of like a chapter, 114 of them. They vary greatly in length. The very longest surah is almost 300 verses long. And that's surah number 2. The shortest are, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 verses long. So you have this enormous variation in the length of the surahs. Each is, of course, a separate revelation of, you know, the angel Gabriel speaking to Muhammad. Oh, and by the way, Muhammad was supposedly illiterate. That means that he would have had to have kept in his head what Gabriel told him until he could find somebody to write it down, or maybe once he had sort of established himself as a prophet, maybe there actually was somebody sitting there, you know, and he was sort of dictating. I don't know. He couldn't possibly keep the entire surah number 2 in his head, which is running almost 300 verses. But anyway, yeah, that's so they have this enormous variation in the and the length of the surahs. Now, by the way, the division into verses, I mean, although the Quran itself is, you know, from God, right? Remember, there's a copy of it in heaven and has been there for eternity. This is merely the human, you know, representation of what exists eternally in heaven. Although that's perfect. The division of it into verses, and certainly into subsections, like, remember I said the other day that some of the longer surahs are divided into sections, which is helpful, especially to an outsider coming in to group them together some. I mean, like surah number 2, for example, I think it's like in 40 sections or something. It's all in my spreadsheet that I sent out last week. At any rate, because the verse divisions are human, that means that no two, various editions of the Quran may actually have different variations in the numbering of the verses. For example, I'm going to quit in just a second. Every surah, except for one of them, begins with a Bismillah. And let me read you what the Bismillah is. All I have to find is, here we go. In the name of Allah, the gracious, the merciful. That's it. Every surah except for number 9 begins with a Bismillah. Now, why does 9 not? I don't have the faintest idea. It just doesn't. But anyway, different editions of the Quran will treat the Bismillah as a verse, and some of them won't. That means then that if you, say, go online, you find a reference to something or other, and you pick up your copy of the Quran and you find the appropriate surah, and then you go to that verse and you read it and you say, wait a minute, that's not there. Well, it'll be somewhere close by. I don't think the Bismillah business is the only way in which the verses differ, but it's a very prominent one, especially because my copy counts it as verse number 1. And a lot of the time, when I've been doing research, both online and in books, I'll see a reference to a verse and I'll look there, and the verse isn't there, but then I go to the very next verse and it's there. And that's because in my copy, every verse is one greater than if you don't count the Bismillah as a separate verse. So just for your own information, if you're interested and if you find references, if you happen to have the Quran and you are interested enough to actually look things up, and you find references and you open your copy and what you find is not what you're supposed to find, it'll be around somewhere within a couple of verses, certainly. It'll be there. It's just because the versification is not consistent among different editions.
That is so good.
And I will close with this. The entire Quran has got its own Bismillah. That is Surah number 1. And I'll read you Surah number 1. Here it is. In the name of Allah, the gracious, the merciful. All praise belongs to Allah, Lord of the worlds, the gracious, the merciful, master of the day of judgment. Thee alone do we worship, and thee alone do we implore for help. Guide us in the right path, the path of those on whom thou hast bestowed thy blessings, those who have not incurred thy displeasure, and those who have not gone astray. That's the invocation. The Bismillah is kind of an invocation to each surah, except for 9. And surah number 1 is kind of the invocation to the entire Quran. Well, we're out of time. We will pick up with this next week, and then I'll talk about the life of Muhammad, the development of Islam, and after that, we'll get into the details of what the prophets, what Muhammad says about each of the prophets, 25 of them. Okay? So, see ya next week. Bye-bye.